From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The gross domestic product takes a serious nosedive in 2008's fourth quarter. Will an almost $900 billion stimulus package help pull us out of the rut of recession? Spend or cut taxes? That is the question. And for answers and more on the state of the economy, we turn now to our regular contributor on all things dollars and cents, Keith Reed. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
It's going great. Thank you very much. We got some pretty grim economic news, however, on Friday, the weakest gross domestic product since Michael Jackson released the Thriller album in the early 80s. President Obama called the situation a, quote, continuing disaster for working families. Now, the GDP shrank nearly 4%, Keith, in the fourth quarter of last year. Help us unpack these figures. What does this GDP slide mean to the average person?
Well, what it means is that the economy is not growing. It's continuing to contract, and like we've said, Tony, over the past few weeks here and past few months, that there is not really there's not really any end to this in sight. When you've got basically shrinkage of the GDP, you've got to remember, and again, this is something that we've talked about. What was driving the economy for so long wasn't really production. It wasn't how much in terms of goods and services we were producing as an economy, so much as it was consumer purchases and particularly large purchases that you had to borrow money for that was keeping the economy afloat. When that went away, when lending in particular went away, there was no way for the economy to rebound because so many other sectors had already shed jobs or sent jobs overseas, or much of the economy had shifted to service sector jobs that just didn't pay like the skilled labor of the past. This is what we've wrought by borrowing so much and continuing to, as a society and as an economy, continuing to move jobs away from those that are well-paying and can sustain middle-class families.
Let's talk about the stimulus package that is getting so much ink these days. The U.S. House, of course, passing one version of the package last week. The bill is now making its way through the Senate. We're talking about more than $800 billion. It's said to be roughly 75% spending, 25% tax cuts. Is this an effective ratio? The Republicans certainly don't seem to think so.
Yeah, and there's actually some doubt, maybe not in on the Democratic side of the aisle in Congress, but definitely from some more liberal economists and some folks who are just observers of this, even on the Democratic or on the more liberal leaning side, that maybe this isn't the right balance or maybe this isn't the right way to go. I think the problem is that you just haven't seen such trouble with the economy in so long that nobody really knows which way is the best way to go in terms of fixing things. I mean, when you're looking at, I think you said it's about $819 billion. I actually heard this morning that what they're debating in the Senate is closer to $900 billion. Do you need more tax cuts? Do you need less spending? I think the spending is what really has to be examined here, because as we heard last week and as the Republicans really hit the Obama administration and the Democrats in Congress on, there are some things being put in this bill that don't have anything to do with economic recovery. And you can debate, for example, the merits of family planning and whether or not that's a good thing or something that the federal government should be participating in. But I think no matter what side of the aisle you're on, how much does that really have to do with the economy? And you could argue, well, that was only $200 million. Yeah, but there are a lot of little $10 million, $200 million, $500 million projects that are being put in this bill. And that's where the debate comes in terms of how much the government can really afford to spend and how targeted that needs to be.
Here's the thing, though. I don't understand why, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people listening who don't understand why there is such disagreement over even economists about this, because can't it be proven one way or the other whether or not spending works better than tax cuts?
It really depends on who you ask. I mean, there are think tanks out there that can produce research that will show almost anything. I think we saw, for example, in the last administration, that there were all manner of right leaning think tanks that could produce data that showed that if you were giving tax cuts to the wealthy and you subscribe to a trickle down formula for the economy, that the economy would recover. Well, now we saw that didn't work. There were a number of opponents on the left side of the aisle that said that, no, that's crazy. If you're going to do tax cuts, you've got to do tax cuts that are smaller than this. You can't do it as we're spending so much money on the war. And if you're going to do tax cuts at all, you got to give them to the middle class. You know, you can find people that produce data on either side of the aisle. And I think what you've got to have is some real pragmatic, nonpartisan relationships being forged, in which they look at this bill and say, "Okay, we're going to have to spend. We're going to have to cut taxes, or at least not raise them. What's really the right ratio?" And stop arguing over it, so that people can begin to recover.
Let's talk about something pragmatic. Let's just presume that the stimulus package has passed in some form, and it has some combination of tax cuts and spending, and this infrastructure can begin. So my question is, in terms of these shovel-ready projects coming out of the stimulus package, how quickly would you say that we could see job creation in this area?
I think it could happen pretty quickly. If you look around the country, especially in some of the Rust Belt states, what you've got is a situation where many of these projects have been put on hold for a while, because it's been a long time since there was a real increase, or at least a big increase, in terms of federal spending on infrastructure projects. Just here in Ohio last week, you had Governor Ted Strickland talk about bringing, in his State of the State address, talk about bringing back passenger rail service between cities in Ohio, and he wants to see that happen. That would be the first time in, I believe, more than 40 years that it happened. It would be a great thing for the economy to see that. It would be a great thing to see rail, as an example, happen in many places around the country where there are regional rail transportation networks that have been on a drawing board and have been discussed, that would bring some people back to work over a considerable amount of time. But the federal dollars simply haven't been there to do that. I think in those situations where the plans are already on the drawing board and you could just take them off the shelf and put them in place, that could happen fairly quickly, within months. Not even, you know, you're looking at maybe 3 months at the latest that you could start putting some people to work in some instances.
Let me shift the conversation just a little bit to this, because in the meantime, while people are waiting for Congress to fight this out and hash it out and actually get those dollars flowing, people are robbing Peter to pay Paul, and sometimes they're robbing Paul as well. We've got all these stories now coming out about smaller Ponzi schemes, a.k.a. Bernie Madoff. They're called mini Madoffs. Madoff, of course, the rogue investor accused of bilking folks out of $50 billion in an elaborate pyramid scheme. One of these is down in the Florida area by a guy by the name of George Theodule. What was he up to, if you know, and why are people getting sucked into these scams?
Well, essentially, what's happening in every one of these cases, not just down in down with Theodule, but or up in New York with Madoff, but essentially, what a Ponzi scheme is when somebody comes to you and says, "Listen, I got a great deal. I've got some good investments for you," and you trust that person. You give that person your money. Only that person doesn't really have an investment, or that person has an investment that is performing poorly, not in the manner in which he told you that it would perform, and bringing you back the returns that you expected to get. In order to cover the losses, that person then goes down the line to the next investor. They take their money, they cover the losses that happened with your money, with the money that they got from the last person, and so on and so on and so forth. Eventually, there's an end game. There was a New York Times story that essentially summed this up by saying, listen, at the end of the day, nobody wins in a Ponzi scheme, because at a certain point you've taken money from so many people that nobody else is going to give you any more money. And when the money runs out, you've got nothing to cover the losses. There never was an investment, or there never was a good investment. I think one of the reasons, Tony, that we're seeing so many of these come to light has really nothing to do with the fact that people are being that this is happening more often, so much as it is the fact that people are just paying attention to it more. You know, you watch the news and somebody says, oh, there's a stolen car ring. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's watching for people breaking into cars. Well, people break into cars every day. But when you hear about it on the news, people start paying attention. There have always been Ponzi schemes. This is not new. This has been going on for forever, has been happening to investors. And it'll continue to go on. But we're just aware of it because the Madoff scandal was so large and so visible.
You know, it's funny. I was listening to your description of the Ponzi scheme as our time is running out, and I couldn't help but think that there must be somebody listening to your description who is saying, wow, the stimulus package, that sounds like a Ponzi scheme to me.
the government covering its own losses by printing more money, which covers losses in which it prints more money. Hey, you know, you could make that argument. I'm not going to make that argument, but somebody might.
Yeah, I mean, we're waiting to see what the end game is going to be with regard mm-hmm. to that. Really quickly, do you think, or do you, there's no way to know, but do you have a sense that the Senate is likely to pass some version of a stimulus bill this week?
Yeah, I think they will. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know if it's going to end up being as large as they're talking about right now. But, I mean, look, the numbers in Congress are what they are. The Democrats can pass this. They don't really need Republican support to pass it. It would be better if they did have some sort of a consensus across party lines. But you know, we know what the numbers are in Congress right now in both chambers and President Obama wants this to happen. So, yeah, they can pass something if they want to.
All right, Keith, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony, and congratulations to my Super Bowl champion Steelers, by the way.
Yes, they are the champions. That was Keith Reed, our regular economics contributor. You can find more of his financial wisdom online at Keith Reed's Money Corner. He joined us from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Pink slips seem to be raining down in just about every sector and every zip code. But are there any bright spots out there? The temporary job market may provide an answer. We're joined now by Steve Drexel. He is a labor economist and a 23-year veteran of the staffing industry. He's also a member of the Business Research Advisory Council of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Steve, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
You've been following temporary staffing trends for more than two decades now. What sectors are relatively insulated from layoffs?
Well, the sectors that are most resilient are the higher skill sectors, or if you can get into industries that are involved in education or healthcare or government, those are the areas where you get the most bang. We're also seeing a nice increase in the mortgage processing area, because one of the things the government's doing is lowering the conforming rate for mortgages, and so there's kind of a rush to refinance.
When you say higher skills, are you talking about engineering, things of that sort?
Well, even within, say, clerical admin, there's always demand for good, you know, personal assistance. There's always demand for engineers or, you know, highly skilled folks. There's sometimes fewer jobs in those areas, but for good people, you can get employed.
Now, geographically, where are the hot spots for temporary work?
We're seeing the best demand really around the D.C. area, you know, Maryland, Virginia, the District of Columbia. Of course, the government's kind of gearing up, and there's lots of activity to, you know, take on some of these new projects. Another good area is Texas. Texas still has some residual goodwill related to energy and utilities. Beyond that, there's most every area of the country is feeling some pinch. Some of the toughest places are California, Nevada, and Florida.
Let's talk about terms for a moment. When we say temporary work, are we talking about an hourly employee who's coming in, say, 4 hours a week, or somebody working 20 hours a week or 4 hours a day, or are we talking about somebody that may sign on for a project that lasts a month, 2 months, 6 months?
Well, most temporary assignments are for, you know, full days at a time or full weeks at a time. So when you're working a temporary assignment, it's generally 8 hours, but it may only be a 2 or 3 day assignment, or there are some folks that work very long term. But generally, it's a 4 to 6 week assignment.
Now, when you take these kinds of jobs, they generally don't come with any of the benefits, health, otherwise, vacation, sick time, etc., that are associated with full-time permanent employment. Is that right?
Well, temporary workers often have the opportunity to participate in health care plans, but for the most part, because they're short-term assignments, maybe only 2 to 12% participate. You generally do get health care opportunities. You get vacation, you get holiday, but those might depend on the length of service or the number of hours that you log.
President Obama signed an executive order on Friday strengthening organized labor. How does this impact temporary workers in particular where unions are involved in the job workplace?
Well, temporary employment companies work side by side with and in unionized establishments. So there's generally work rules or understandings that the employing company will, you know, will enforce or will obligate the temporary company to participate in. Temporary assignments, though, we don't cross picket lines generally, and we don't refill positions first when union workers go on strike. So there's a coexistence there. And so far, there hasn't been a lot of unionization of the temporary employment workforce, but some of the legislation that's pending may make that more of an issue.
Now, another component to the unemployment situation is something called shadow layoffs. Government numbers show that in 2006, independent contractors and self-employed workers made up a third of the workforce. But these folks don't show up in the official pink slip tallies. How are they being affected by cutbacks?
Well, you're right. The in the temporary workforce, for example, which is only something between 2 and 3 million of the employment, so that's a smaller portion. But temporary worker employment's down about 20%. When you look at total employment, it's down about 2%. So one of the things that temporary workers or contract workers or self-employed workers offer employers is flexibility. So when there's a slowdown, when there's less project work, when there's less money available for financing, new projects, mergers and acquisitions, those kinds of things, the flexible workers generally take a harder hit than usual. And there's plenty of evidence to support that. You know, one measure of unemployment, which is called U6, which includes people that are underemployed or are working temporary or part-time because they can't find other work, that's up to like 13.5%. And we see that the average work week at 33.3 hours is at a historic low. So you're right, there's no question the flexible workers are taking it harder.
We haven't talked about pay, and in the few moments that we have left, let's talk about that. In terms of the temporary workforce, is the pay on par with those who are working permanently? Is it below? Is it in some cases higher?
Well, to the extent that people are coming into entry-level jobs, it might be lower than the average wage for that skill classification. But often, because they're working part-time and with less certainty or with less access to the company benefits, sometimes there's a bit of a premium for working temporary or contract, and that's kind of the trade-off for some of the security or some of the access to you know, the benefits that you might get in a more permanent situation.
Let me squeeze one more question in here really quickly. The ratio of temporary workers to permanent workers, what is it, and is it changing?
Well, temporary workers are about 1.2% of the work, or 1.5% of the workforce. It's been as high as almost 2%. So that reflects the a bigger decline in temporary workers than permanent workers. But as you suggested, if you include, you know, all the contract workers and the self-employed folks, you get up to more like a third, and that's dramatically up in the cycle. If you go back to say 2001, last time we had a recession, it's growing and it's pretty dramatic.
Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Steve Drexel is a labor economist and a 23-year veteran of the staffing industry. He is a member of the Business Research Advisory Council of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, it's true the economy is struggling, but not every business has been left out in the cold. Tamara Ingram runs a photography studio in Chicago's Hyde Park, and these days her business is booming. Tamara joins us now. Hi, Tamara.
Hi, how are you, Tony?
Fine. Congratulations to you for making some money when everybody is struggling. That's good news, isn't it?
It is. It's excellent news that it's recession-proof business, so I'm very thankful for that.
What is it that makes it recession-proof in your view?
Well, in most cases, people need photography to advance their careers. People need headshots for corporate and politics, and models need comp cards and headshots, and it's ever-evolving. It doesn't stop.
Well, I would think that you're right. People need all of those things, but in a down economy, people need a lot of other things that they're learning to do without as well. And you would think, perhaps, that with the sophistication of photographic technology, everybody's got cameras now, even on their phones, that they might be forced to go that route. And yet, in your case, they seem to be coming to you anyway. Why is that?
Because people only have one chance to make a first impression. They can lose a gig for trying to put something together themselves, so they rely on a professional to do something.
Tell us a little bit about your business, the background, how large it is, how long you've been doing it, how you built it up, and how you tried to make sure that you could continue to survive even in a down economy.
Well, I've been doing it professionally for about 5 years. I went to school for it. I'm also a writer, so I've kind of juggled both. I built my business on just being accessible to people who are in need of my services. I've been affected by corporate America downsizing, which had nothing to do with the economy of what people are going through now. So I'm pretty flexible with my pricing. I base my prices on what people can afford in some cases because I know how hard it is. And that's attractive to people.
Does it have anything to do at all, and I'm not suggesting that it does, I'm merely asking, does your success have anything to do with the fact that you're located in the hometown of the Obamas and everything seems to be happening in Chicago right now?
Oh, wow. Actually, it doesn't, but it doesn't hurt either. I'm very proud to be living in Chicago and a neighbor of Barack Obama's. It certainly helps.
Now, the kind of photography that you are doing that is bringing in the customers, I got the impression from your first answer that it's really about doing headshots for resumes as opposed to doing pictures of portraits of babies or family portraits, things of that sort.
I do that as well. People still want to capture special moments, whether it's their weddings, their anniversaries, fundraisers, christenings, baptisms. People still spend money to make these things happen. Despite the economy, people aren't sacrificing their social lives.
Now, in terms of your professional colleagues, would you say, Tamara, that the photography business in general is to an extent recession-proof, or is it your business in particular that is surviving because of your business acumen?
I'm a firm believer that people do business with people they like. So I would definitely say that it has something to do with who I am and how I connect and network with people. I do know quite a few people. But at the same token, I think that most photographers are doing well if they're business-minded and know how to market themselves.
Now, would you say that the people that you do business with, your suppliers of film or of cameras or repair or paper or lights or studio setup, all of those things that you are interacting with other business people to do your business, are they thriving in the way that you are?
That's a good question. I would think that they are. It's one of those businesses where you have to always have top-notch equipment if you want to continue to be on top of your game. So I continually purchase and reinvest in myself, so I have to imagine that other photographers are doing it as well. And in turn, those vendors are doing well.
Are there other businesses that you know of, either people that you personally know or read about or have some interaction with at the professional business level, who are flourishing and who may not be in the photography business but are still doing well?
I do an event once a month, so where I throw an event for a club owner, and they seem to be doing very well. I get an extra large turnout every month, and it's growing. So I would say that's another business that's recession-proof. If people will tend to scrape up a few dollars to go out and have a good time, they may not have the mortgage for that month, but at least they can feel good about themselves.
Now, you're doing well right now. Give us a sense of how long you have been doing well, and do you foresee in your business forecast that business is going to continue on a stable footing, or is it? Do you anticipate that it will get even bigger and better?
As it stands now, it's getting bigger and better, and I am very hopeful that it would stay that way. At the same token, I know that it takes a smart business person to run a successful business. So it's all about how you position yourself. I'm continuously networking and meeting with people and developing relationships with some very prominent people, so therefore business is prospering, and I will continue to do that.
But it would seem to me, and perhaps you can offer some clarification on this point, that there are a lot of people who are in business, such as yourself, who are good at what they do, who are conscientious, who are working hard, and yet who find themselves, for whatever reasons, not doing and not being as successful as they would like. And there must be something that separates you from them besides perhaps your business plan and your enthusiasm. Is that realistic?
That is very realistic. I think that goes with any position. You have singers, actors, and a lot of them have been in the business for years and have never made it, if you will, because certain people have it and certain people don't. You either have a drive and a knack for really connecting with people and making some things happen for yourself. Or you can be as talented as the next person, but may never go anywhere with that talent if you don't have the right connections, the right personality, and the right know-how.
You said that you live near the Obamas in Chicago in the Hyde Park area, right?
Yes.
Have you photographed them, or have they been clients of yours?
Not paying clients, but yes, I have shot them at the rally in Chicago.
Okay, not paying in the sense that you would like to have them as clients or pursue them at one point, or you just are taking pictures of them as everyone else is doing when they're out in public.
No, I was part of the campaign. I was heavily involved in fundraising and caring, and have gone to battleground states signing up voters. I was there, part of the group, and I shot them because this is something I wanted to do. I wasn't a paid photographer of staff, but yes. Would I like to shoot them as a paid person? Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm guessing the answer to that would be yes. Are you hopeful of that opportunity still?
Absolutely, I am.
All right, well, good luck to you. We hope that you get it someday.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tamir. Tamir Ingram is the CEO of TI Photography in Chicago, Illinois. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. The Super Bowl ended in a record-setting win by the Pittsburgh Steelers, but what about those commercials? The Smithsonian wants Aretha Franklin's Heather Gray inauguration hat, and a single mother of six gives birth to octuplets. For more on the stories lighting up the blogosphere, we turn now to our Bloggers Roundtable with Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics Blog, Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman Blog, and Corey Richardson of the blog Vexed in the City. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hello, Tony.
So I'm assuming Everybody saw the Super Bowl yesterday, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the Steelers pulled out a historic victory over the Cardinals in yesterday's really it was just one of the better Super Bowls that you've ever seen, I'm sure. Jennifer Hudson staged an amazing comeback with her rendition of the Star Spangled Banner after her family tragedy that we all know about. And as usual, we saw some funny commercials during the big game. One of them that stood out for us here at News and Notes was called Cash for Gold. It featured MC Hammer and Ed McMahon. Here it is.
Here's money. With gold at an all-time high, now's the time to send your unwanted gold for cash, like these gold cufflinks.
I could get cash for this gold medallion of me wearing a gold medallion.
This gold microphone.
My gold records.
My gold golf clubs.
My gold sledgehammer, baby.
Boom.
Today.
My gold giraffe.
My gold pants.
My gold hip replacement.
We melting gold, baby.
Charles, I was at a party. Everybody went crazy when they saw that because it's like you couldn't believe these guys whose legendary problems with money, you know, that's what makes the commercial so funny, isn't it?
It's obvious it is. But you know what? This was what I call retro television. I mean, think about it. Each one of these guys are pretty much washed up. That wasn't the one that got me, man. It was the moose, man. The moose was the bomb diggity one. The guy's sitting in there, and he's got the front end of the moose in one hand and the back end of the moose, and you're wondering, am I at the back end of the moose?
That's a pretty good one. Tempest, which one got you?
Actually, I only saw very few of the commercials because I was floating in and out of the room while the Super Bowl was on. I'm the only person in my family who doesn't much care for football, but I think I did see the Cash for Gold one because someone called me into the room as it was playing in order to point out its complete ridiculousness, and I think that one pretty much did me for the evening.
Well, you know, that's true. And Corey, I don't know about you, but like I said, where I was, it was hard to hear the commercials because people were talking and making so much noise. Does one stand out for you?
Well, I think with the Cash for Gold one, I think it's a definite sign of the times when broke celebrities are what's hot in the streets. When celebrity poverty becomes something we look at and go, yeah, that guy. I'm broke like him. That was one. I think the other one that really got my attention was the one where the guy was punching the koala, the CareerBuilder.com.
Yeah, with the glasses on.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think we've all had those times where it's like, yeah, punching a koala would be great right about now.
Well, you know, did you like the Doritos one? I thought that one was great.
Where he chomped on it and the woman's clothes came off, that one?
Pretty much.
That one didn't suit me too well.
Didn't resonate with you too much.
Fun times.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let me ask you generally, because, you know, when it first kind of got into this cultural thing about commercials at Super Bowl, people began to look for the commercials as much as the games, and there have been some Super Bowls where the commercials were better than the game itself. I didn't get that sense yesterday. This seems to be rebounding a little bit. Some of the commercials were good. Some of them kind of tacky, wouldn't you say, Corey?
Well, I think depending on what you're advertising, that's really what your that tells a story. I mean, the guys who do beer, they always come consistently with great commercials. The spots that I was really impressed by were the movie trailers. I don't know, as a young man at the age of 30, when I saw the trailer for G.I. Joe the movie, I immediately high-fived the guy next to me. When I saw the Transformers 2 trailer, I high-fived him again. And then we saw the Star Trek trailer, we just hugged. Because it was, you know, it's like, you know, all of the movies from my childhood and my inner dork was just so happy to see all that. Those were the spots that really got me.
Well, you know, let's talk just briefly about the ads that did not make it to air. NBC rejected a provocative ad from the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, that featured scantily clad models posing suggestively with fruits and vegetables. So the audience didn't get to see it, but there was much ado made about the fact that NBC pulled that ad. Tempest, what's your opinion of that, or pulling it?
Well, I think that it was probably a good choice to pull it because beyond the fact that the ad was not all that wonderful, I feel like they're being a little bit disingenuous, though, because there's plenty of, you know, like sexy, you know, provocative, you know, ads of that nature during the Super Bowl. So I'm not sure exactly what their reasoning was for saying that PETA's was like too sexy or, you know, whatever reasoning they had for it. I thought that the commercial itself was in poor taste, but then they get a lot of PR for being rejected by NBC. I'm sure thousands of people have watched that video online now.
I would think so, Charles. And I think to Tempest's point, you know, there does seem perhaps to be a double standard here. You talk about sexiness, and they did have a commercial with two women in the shower. I don't know how much sexier.
Can you say $100,000? Because that's what they got fined for the Janet Jackson video. And I think everybody's so gun-shy about what you show and what you don't show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the FCC has really forced many of the networks to rethink not just the actual content of the game and what parts of the content to show, but they're scrutinizing everything. And, you know, that last fine, you know, they finally got it removed by the FCC. But, you know, every time you put something on like that, you got to wonder if somebody from the FCC is going to knock on your door.
Well, you know, it's absolutely right. And talking about the FCC's indecency rules, one of the things that got them, meaning CBS at the time, was the fact that when children are available to watch, the rules are more strict. So during those hours when children are up, if you put certain things on television or say them on the radio, you're subject to be fined by the FCC. All right, let's go on to talk about something else, because this has been a story that's gained traction all around the country and beyond, actually. A single California woman gave birth to octuplets last week, which in and of itself, certainly newsworthy, only the second time apparently that's happened here. But since she gave birth, it's been revealed that she, as I've already said, is not married, is struggling financially, and has six children at home already. I'm not sure where to go with this, Tempest, when you first...
Was this about the money? That's what I want to know, because why would you... I mean, a social worker should have stepped in and said, are you sure that you need some more children based on where your circumstances are? Because the only obvious question is, the doctors were looking to get paid. I mean, help me out here, Tempest. Is that what was going on here?
I don't know. I don't know if I could say that, because of the stuff that I've read about it... It appears that she came to the medical team once she was already pregnant. This
Correct.
Medical team was not the one responsible for actually giving her the embryos, implanting the embryos in her. So I think that was a calculated move on her part for her not to, you know, go to the hospital and say, put eight embryos in me and then deliver the babies, because somebody might have had a little something to say about that. But by going to two different doctors, I think that she effectively got her desire, but she probably figured that people would have something to say about it. Is it about the money on the medical team's part? I wouldn't necessarily say so. Is it about the money on her part? Quite possibly, if only because whenever somebody has more than four babies, everybody, you know, the whole country gets involved. Or I should say, whenever a white person has more than four babies, because there have been some allegations of, you know, less media coverage for black women who have multiple births.
Well, she's not black, but she got an awful lot of play. Let me just answer one of the things that Charles brought up with regard to what she was doing. Her mother has been quoted in the papers out here in California saying that her daughter just loves children. And apparently she is a single woman who was a professional, college educated, got laid off from her job, according to the press accounts, and decided to do this. The question, though, Corey, is does the person who implanted her have any ethical responsibility to inquire about her previous births, and should that be a factor in determining whether or not to give her additional infertilization?
No. I think the person who implanted her was just trying to get paid. I mean, my thing here is not a moral issue. It's not ethics. My problem here is logistics. You need a commercial driver's license to operate a vehicle that carries more than 11 passengers. And this woman's got 14 kids. So she's going to need a bus, or she needs a CDL. How do you fit all these people in a house? How do you all go any one place at any one time? Why are we not requiring people to have licenses to have children? You know,
well,
you need a license
to fish.
I don't
know if you require people to have licenses, but there's got to be some due diligence here. I mean, come on. Someone's got to step up to the plate and say, look, in the broader scope of things, we know you love children. Why don't you adopt some? Okay? You can get through one more of these. Okay? Then we'll give you another one. But right now, I think, if you think about it, this woman will be on public assistance for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not going to be able to go out and work. Tell me how she gets a job, because I don't see it.
So here's my question then, Charles, to follow up with your point. So how do you tell her the next time she goes in, and she's got 14 now, and she wants 18 because she wants two more boys, or three
more
girls.
How do you do that? I don't want to put limitations, but I think there's got to be a red flag bulletin at every fertility clinic. If this woman shows up, you have to tell her no. I mean, the worst part would be to say, look, ma'am, we're going to tie your tubes. You're not going to be able to have children. You know, they used to do that back in the 40s. But now I don't think that is morally right to do. I think that we as a society have to come to a simple conclusion. You're out of the baby business. At least I hope she is.
All right, we're going to keep our eyes on this. So let me just let folks know that if you're just tuning in, I'm Tony Cox. This is NPR's News and Notes. And with me on today's Bloggers Roundtable are Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog and Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog and Corey Richardson of the blog Vexed in the City. Normally on News and Notes, we do politics on Wednesday's Blogger, but I wanted to get this in because I thought it was important. Republican National Committee has chosen Michael Steele to serve as party chairman. He is the former lieutenant governor of the state of Maryland, the first black chairman of the Republican Party. An interesting pick. I heard him say today, Charles Robinson, he wants to be the party of the hip-hop Republicans and the Frank Sinatra Republicans. Is that doable?
Well, he's going to have – he got a lot going on there. Let me just say that Michael Steele, I've been covering him for the last 8-9 years, and he was a lieutenant governor here in Maryland. And, yes, he was one of the few people that would reach out to hip-hop entrepreneurs such as Russell Simmons, and he got him to sign on to his campaign. Will he be able to bring that group together? It's a mixed bag. I mean, I went to a rally he had with Russell Simmons, and one of the things I thought was interesting is everybody there was texting. And that was a problem that the Democrats didn't hop onto in the early phase. And now with the Barack Obama phenomenon, they have. What does Michael Steele have to do? First of all, he's got to broaden this tent like nobody's business. But the problem is that they don't have an answer. I mean, as far as they're concerned, it's no, 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 no. You got to have more than no, especially in these economic times.
Well, Corey Richardson, it's one thing to put a black person as the head of the party, but as Charles was saying, the reason that they lost the election to Barack Obama wasn't because black folks alone did not vote for the Republicans. They lost the young vote. They lost the women. They lost a number of other sectors, and the question is whether or not this election is going to help them make up the ground that they lost.
Well, I think that when you look at the candidates for RNC chairman across the board, there's an old saying, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And in this situation, Michael Steele was the one-eyed man. You had a litany of just poorly qualified candidates for the job, and they picked the one guy who was the best least qualified. I don't think that the Republicans, by just putting a black guy in this position, are answering any of the real Republican Party problems, which are, where are your ideas? Who's actually leading your party? Is it a party of ideas, or is it a party of Rush Limbaugh? I'm more than anything else just perplexed at how Michael Steele got on Fox News yesterday and said basically that they're not changing anything about the party. And if that's one thing that they should have learned from this election, is that their party needs to change.
Well, let me bring Tempest in to get her view of what you think he could accomplish as the head of the RNC.
You know, I'm actually not sure. Just looking at, what reports have come out, I've read some of the coverage on him going back a little while. And I agree. He doesn't seem to bring anything to the party that could really affect a sea change in Republicanism, and not necessarily a sea change that would change the fundamentals, but a sea change that would make them relevant, that would make them more of use to their base, even with their conservative values. I'm just not seeing it.
I would think too, Charles, and this would be our last comment on this because our time is up, that with Barack Obama in the White House, he doesn't have much of a chance at all to reach out to African Americans to switch. He may have those who are already on the Republican side, but it's not likely he's going to pull any black Democrats.
I think it's going to be Hispanics and Latinos he's going to reach out to. And the reason why I say that is because right now African Americans are solidly, probably 98, maybe even 99% behind the current president. But you know what? In the course of a political season, things can change.
That is absolutely true. Thank you all very much. Good discussion today.
Thank you.
That was Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog, joining us from WEAA Studios in Baltimore, Maryland. Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog, she joined us from NPR Studios in New York. And Corey Richardson of the blog Vexed in the City, he joined us from KUT in Austin, Texas.